This is gonna hurt. It's time for the Suffering Podcast.
Our life focus goes in a direction that we best see as matching our ambition. We have an idealistic, unreal reality, painting a roadmap to where we're supposed to be, only seeing the grim finish below the glossy veneer once we're inside. Life takes an unexpected turn, and we're forced to change our perspective. This change allows the opening of new doors and fixing what you might have seen as broken, shedding the tunnel vision and creating opportunity that replaces frustration. Now, with clear eyes, we can emerge to do what we're meant to do. Our life's calling yells in our deaf ears until we're ready to hear them. Where you end is not where you begin, but where you are is where you belong. I'm Kevin Donaldson here with Mike Felasin. On this episode of the Suffering Podcast, we welcome Dennis Benigno. I hope I said that right.
See, close enough.
It's the Italian.
It ends in a vowel. You always screw up.
And on this episode of the Suffering Podcast, we sit down with Dennis to discuss the suffering of street cop training. Dennis is providing a much needed asset to our law enforcement community. Thank you so much for coming in.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me.
Could travel in all this way from East Windsor, right?
It's a hike, man. It's an hour and a half. Yeah, you came down, right?
I did. Before we get into anything, let's give a big shout out to our marquee sponsor. That's Toyota of Hackensack. We don't trust anybody as police, but we do trust Toyota of Hackensack. So if you're looking for a car, go to toyotaofhackensack.com. Let them find you a car. We gotta pay the bills around here, you know.
I get it, brother.
They found my father a car too.
Oh, which is nice.
Which was a hard thing. Old school Italian. Yeah,
that was it's wrapped in steel. He likes to hit things. Mm.
I am such an admirer of the work that you're doing in street cop training that I'm very happy that your producer, Frankie, reached out and brought you in today because I think you're taking one life as a young man and you're expounding upon it by providing much needed training and information to our law officers. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
What we say, it's helping cops get home.
That's right. That's all it is. We just want people to go home and see their families. Dennis, each week we take a question from our audience. This week's question comes from Cyrus the Virus. That's actually why I grabbed this one, because I love that movie. We've all learned from our mentors and our older vets when we got on the job as police. But inevitably, there is something that impressed you. So Cyrus says, what impressed you the most early on in your career? Dennis, you're our guest. I'm going to pass this one off to you.
I don't know if I have a particular moment that I can remember on a whim like this, but I remember when I first started learning about how people who were not the tough guys, were not pretending to be tough guys, would communicate with folks. So I saw one side of where communication would be very rugged and rough and sound very overbearing and dictatorial. And then I saw how people worked or wanted to work with the men and women on the job who were more personable and friendly, and how much more cooperation and success they had by being so polite and friendly when maybe everybody else wasn't being that way. And that's when I recognized that this is just a better way to do it. It doesn't look as tough or as cool, but this is definitely the better way to do it. So I don't know if there's anybody in particular. I can think of a lot of people in my head that I saw who displayed these behaviors. And that's a real superpower as a law enforcement officer.
That's a good answer. Yeah, that's a real good answer. Mike, what do you think?
Well, you know, back in my rookie days, you know, we were in a locker room and I saw a guy drop his pants.
And he got impressed? Yeah. Way to bring it right down there.
No, seriously. Like you said, it's the way people project themselves. You know, you don't have to be a tough ass. You don't have to be like this real hard, rugged cop. It's all about communication. But to me, the thing that really impressed me when I was younger, you know, younger in my career, was the way people dressed, the way they kept their uniform. That's a good answer. It's command presence. You know, you show up with donut stains on your shirt or your shirt hanging out, you're not going to get that respect. You see someone that's squared away, you know, fit uniform. I mean, I had every one of my uniforms tailored to fit.
That's what I don't like about those new BDUs. That, and I understand it's more comfortable for the cops. I get that. But there was something about an officer who got out of their car, crisp, clean lines, you know, shoes shine, you look good, because it's half the battle how you look.
You know, the outer vests make everybody look heavy now.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, when you showed up to a scene.
Listen, I'm going to disagree, because when you're a jacked up dude and you show up in an outer car, you now look more, I mean, but, look more of a command presence.
It's more imposing. It's more imposing, but you see a guy walk up and he's got that fucking V going.
That was my drill. My drill was that way. I mean, if he gained 2 pounds, you'd know it.
Yeah.
Because his uniform was tight.
Mm-hmm. I love the outer vest, because to me that's tactical. You know, and you got more room to put stuff and everything. But I think a nice crisp uniform, that's the thing that's why I got into law enforcement. So I said it years ago. My uncle was a captain in Port Authority Police. And he's the reason I got in law enforcement, because he looked so jacked up in a uniform. I was like, that's what I want to be like.
Yeah, it's cool.
I got two incidents. First incident, it was the first time a supervisor, you know, you get accused of certain things when you pull a car over. You pulled me over for this reason, you pulled me over for that reason, and some of them are very derogatory. And most of them, at the end of the day, are to get out of whatever you pulled them over for. I had a supervisor very early on in my career sit, really chide the person and stand the person up and say, you apologize to this officer. That's not what he did. You got pulled over for A, B, and C, which is very clearly evident on your vehicle. And I remember the feeling that I had. I felt good. Okay. I felt like, okay, well, somebody's got my back. That same sergeant, you know, you get on the job, you're brand new, and people call you kid. You don't know anything until you got 5 years on the job. And part of that is true. You don't want to hear that. I don't like the term rookie for that reason. What he said when somebody had said, oh, he's just a kid, he doesn't know anything, he goes, stop. He's brand new out of the academy. His knowledge of 2C is far superior to yours, because it's fresh in his mind. He may not have the street experience, but that'll come. That'll come in time. And it's that sergeant, who I'm still friends with today, he's been retired for 20 years. I'm still friends with him to this day. I respect him, because he really... he instilled me with a lot of confidence. And as a new officer, that's, you can show confidence, but you don't have confidence yet. That willingness to admit that he has more knowledge than I have, being a 20-year veteran in book law. You know, experience is a little bit different thing. Cyrus.
Kev, do you think, though, when people say you only pulled me over to this, for this or for that, do you think that's them trying to get you off your game?
I think it's being fed information.
Yeah.
I really do. I think it's being fed information, and it's an excuse to try to get out of something, get you on your heels a little bit.
Yeah, get you off your game.
Yeah. So sometimes it is true. Unfortunately,
sometimes it does works. Happen. Sometimes it works.
And a lot of times it works, especially this day and age. Cyrus, thank you so much for sending that one in. Keep sending in your questions. We will try to get them on the air. So Dennis, you know, listen, I've done my research about you. You run this large company that's doing great things for law enforcement. You're a retired law enforcement officer, and you chose to stay in the field. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
I'm a Jersey boy. Always been a Jersey boy. Wanted to be a cop, I think, since as far back as I can remember, even though that my actions in high school and middle school and
most
and elementary school probably didn't reflect the fact that I had an intention to go into law enforcement.
Well, I always said the best cops are the street smart cops.
There's no question
about it. The guys that, you know, you have the fine line between good and bad, and the good cops kind of straddle that line a little bit.
Well, let me ask you this. Being retired, how long have you been retired?
8 years.
8 years, okay.
7 years, 3 months, and 13 days.
I'm coming up on almost 9 years straight. Now, in your travels outside of law enforcement, I'm sure you've met a lot of ex-criminals. Guys who have done some time, some serious time.
Of course. Okay. I mean, I worked in jail to start.
Okay. How many of those guys who are ex-criminals, retired criminals, are you friendly with?
I don't know any of them.
No, you don't. See, with Mike and I, we found that those guys who have retired from their profession that we used to go against, we have so much in common with them, because our mindsets and our personalities are very similar. We just went in two different paths.
That's right.
But they're all type A personalities. They're all strong-willed. They all want to do what they want to do to the best of their ability. It's just we separated somewhere.
What do you usually say, like the differences in us bring us closer together? Or
there's more that brings us together than separates us.
Yeah.
It's kind of like I always equate it to whenever they used to have the Gettysburg reunions, the old Civil War vets from both sides used to meet at Gettysburg, and they'd have a reunion, even both sides, and they shake hands. This is where we fought. You're retired soldiers of the battlefield, and you return to bring it back home. So it makes perfect sense that you towed that line in high school. Did you ever get in
popped.
Trouble for any of those?
Yeah, popped.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The statute of limitations is over, so we can talk about it.
Yeah, I don't know. We did a podcast with a friend of mine recently, and we talked about a lot of shit, and he called me like the next day, and he's a very well-known person, and he's like, hey, we got to cut some of that stuff out. He's like, been thinking about it. And I'm like, no, I agree. If you're not comfortable with it, that's fine.
Yeah.
But we're just trying to correlate business back to who we were and how innovative we were as kids and savvy in business or similar businesses that procure revenue, albeit some of them probably not super legal, not highly illegal.
It's what they call theft today.
Yeah, but you know what? It's when you do something that's skirting that line, it's an adrenaline rush.
Yeah, I think that we were just creative and we were lower middle class kids who wanted to learn how to make a buck. You know, who in a lower middle class neighborhood is going to put their arm around you and teach you about business when everybody that lives there is a factory worker, right? So, like, when you think about that, we were seeking more but had no guidance. Mm. So we did what we thought we were supposed to do. There was no internet. There's a time you have to pay for pornography. People don't realize that.
It's disgusting.
And actually go buy the videos in the store.
Let me just explain that process for the young people who don't know what that was like. So, yes, you had to go to a store, usually a convenience store. And there was a section of the convenience store that was...
The kids weren't allowed in.
Well, there was so it was behind maybe a small wall. But if you went back there, you could still see the top of your head typically. So, first of all, you had to make sure that the store was completely empty, especially if it was close to your house. Then you had just seconds to go back there, and you had about maybe five genres to pick from. So you had one, not like 7,000 today.
Where
you
it wasn't just, these fetishes.
Yeah, you could think things up and just type it in. You'll find something on it. Now it's just, it was five straight up. This is this.
Playboy, Hustler, Penthouse.
Yes. Well, what's even talking about videos? I mean, there was only certain things. I mean, I don't want to go too graphic here, but that's it. You know, you had five genres to choose from, and if you thought that was the most embarrassing part, then you had to bring the DVD or VHS tape up to the counter to typically a New Jersey, an Indian dude who would look at the thing and go, big tits. Huh? I'm lesbians. Huh? Me too. I like this. Right. And you're just like, God, dude, just put it in the fucking brown bag.
Or if you eventually,
I saw this video last night. Very good.
Yeah. Just
very
like, good.
If you ever had the courage to venture into one of those cinder block buildings.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did too.
Yeah. That took some courage, and like, yeah, they show you, we got some booths in the back. It's like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Well, at some point when I was 18, that was the only options, folks. Yeah. This wasn't some kind of thing. And I was worried about going into those places.
Yeah. You take your life into your hand, but there was always that odd person, just like in even today, if you go into a convenience store that has one of those sections with the magazines, there's always some random creepy guy hanging around that section.
He's lurking about.
Yeah.
You want to hear something crazy? I went maybe a while back, my wife and I went to a adult variety store at night, goofing off. And so we walk in, and she knows the girl who's working behind the counter. It's a nice one. It's down South Jersey. It's nicer. It's not as bad as you think it is. And it was actually a pretty nice store. It wasn't some like sleazeball place. And so she's talking to her. She's like, oh, are you the cop? And I'm like, yeah, yeah. She's like, where do you work? I'm like, next town over. You know, I'm over here. She's like, oh, that's cool. At the same time, this dude is in there shoplifting expensive vibrators, like ones that are like $250, $300 a piece. And she's like, he's a cop. He's going to arrest you. And I'm like, oh, my God. Could you imagine this? What I'm going to have to do? She knows I'm a cop. If this dude starts getting crazy in here, I got to do something, right? I got a pistol on me. And I'm going to have to try to explain to my agency why I apprehended somebody while shopping in a adult variety store.
That's called creative writing.
Why? Well, it's not even creative writing. She's like, could you imagine this story? Like, yeah, what did Benito get into today? I locked somebody up off duty shoplifting vibrators.
I think the scarier thing is you walked into a sex shop with your wife and the girl. The first time you walk into a sex shop with your wife and the girl,
they went to high school together, Mike. They went to high school together.
Knows your wife.
A suspicious.
You're back again.
Here's how that report would go. Witness a suspicious male walking into a commercial building.
Yeah.
He made an assertive movement.
Yeah.
Which is always the go-to. He made an assertive movement, and I enacted an arrest.
And I saw a big black thing hanging out of his hands. I thought it was a gun.
But so when you were a brand new officer, how long did you always carry an off duty?
I mean, as soon as I can carry. I mean, I got in the job when I was 19, right? So the minute I got the permission to carry an off-duty weapon is the very second that I carried an off-duty weapon.
And did that continue?
I have a gun on me now.
Oh, okay. Well, that's comforting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry if I offended. That was
the one thing.
I'm not a gun guy. I just, for me, I would hate to be put in a predicament of having the ability to intervene and stop something very significant from happening. And dude, it'd have to be a pretty high threshold for me to get involved. I'm not getting involved on some stupid shit. Basically, active shooter or some kind of significant loss of life is imminent and going to happen. I would hate to have the ability or the authority to still be able to carry a pistol and find myself in a situation like that and not be prepared to have at least done something. Because if your kids are in there, I see them as my kids.
Yeah. I'd rather be caught with it than without it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not somebody who is looking to get involved in anything. I even had the thought on the way up. I'm like, all right, I got my gun. I mean, like, if somebody comes out here, I'm in traffic on the parkway, right, and, like, wants my car, I'm probably going to give them the car. You know, yeah. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to shoot somebody over the car. I just don't know if I want to even deal with those headaches of shooting somebody over the car.
Especially what you do now, you see, you hear the horror stories all around.
Yeah.
But now growing up, what drew you to law enforcement?
You know, I think that it comes down to probably some deep psychological stuff. I hate fucking bullies. They make me insane. My father was a very, very big bully.
Do you know Jay Aponte?
Yeah. It's a story of healing because I bullied a kid in 7th and 8th grade, felt bad. He left after 8th grade, felt bad about it my entire life. 30 years I hunted him down to apologize. Yeah. Finally found him.
Yeah.
And it was cathartic.
I bet.
It was awesome. And here's the sad part. Guy's a cop. The guy's a cop in New York. I lost a friend that I could have had a really good friend for 30 years. And him and I were pretty tight now. For that reason, like, you know, I consider him one of my oldest friends, even though I treated him like shit. Yeah. But I treated him like shit for different reasons because there was something wrong with me.
Correct.
Wrong with him. But that's an honorable reason to get involved in law enforcement because you want to stop bullies. You want to take care of people who may not have the ability to take care of themselves.
That's exactly everything about it, dude.
Yeah. And now once you got, 19, getting a pension system on 19, that's a beautiful thing.
Well, don't forget, I paid a lot of dues up front. I was going to police academy at 4:30 in the morning when all my friends were coming back from Rutgers. Yeah. Shit face, talking about hooking up with chicks. But my head shaved 20 miles from here running Camp Gore Road in Bergen County, New Jersey.
Bergen County
5:30 in the morning, freezing my ass off at 19, you know? So I couldn't even drink.
Yeah, but in a lot of ways, those kids coming back from Rutgers may be a little shiftless with where their direction of their career is going, and you had a direction.
For sure. Listen, I have no beef with it or qualms, just that the early entry also came with a lot of sacrifice. I mean, dude, I started off in corrections, all right, that they gave me a job when I was 19. I left there in about 2 years. And I mean, I was working New Year's Eve on double shifts, stuck in the jail. I was dealing with horrible, horrible people constantly. We're in a nice housing unit. You know, I learned a lot very quickly. But, you know, I did miss a lot for the back end ability to leave early. So there were dues. I did pay dues. Like, a friend of mine's a very successful realtor. You will see his signs all throughout New Jersey. Rob sells New Jersey. What you don't know is Rob punted 18 to 31. All he did was work Easter, Christmas. The guy never stopped. That's why he's the most successful realtor in New Jersey. People say, oh, he's so lucky. Lucky. He missed 13 years of his life, and he missed a lot of those experiences, which he's learning about in his 30s into 40s, the things that we learned in our 20s about relationships and dating. He just never did it because he was so consumed with being successful. So there was a trade-off.
Because people see the finish line. They don't see the training going up to the marathon that you just ran. You know, they don't see those days of sacrifice, waking up 4:30 in the morning, you know, not being able to go.
Three academies.
Yeah, well,
you know, it's the same thing with, like, bodybuilding. They see people in these shows, and they're huge. They don't see the build-up to that.
No, they don't. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to get on so early and you retire, everybody's like, wow, you retired early. That's great. That's wonderful. Yeah, well, now I got to make up for the time that I lost.
Time lost.
As a kid. So that
was good and bad to it. I mean, I'm not complaining. It was my path. I have no beef with it at all. I'm glad that I took the path that I did. I couldn't figure out my third academy, why I was in another academy. And like in 4.5 years, I was like, why
three?
I left, went federal, and then came back. Oh. And they wouldn't waive me. And so I could be waived.
So you did the CO Academy?
went to Bergen for 17 weeks.
Yeah.
I went to FLETC for basically 6 months, Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. And then I came back 20 months later and went through Somerset here. And that was the worst academy of them all. And I could not believe that for my third one, I was going to the worst academy in the state.
Why wouldn't he waive you, though?
Because they don't give a fuck.
Yeah,
exactly. It's not their money. They don't run places like their businesses. They don't give a shit about me. And it's easier. And their excuse was, well, if we need your training records, we don't want to have to call down to Washington, D.C. to get them. We just can call over to Somerset and they'll give us your stuff, which is a big crock of shit.
They used to do that with OC spray. Like our department used to spray us every year. When you get OC sprayed once, you're certified.
You're certified.
And they would say, well, just in case.
By the way, you don't need to be sprayed with OC to be certified. You never need to be.
No,
never.
You don't.
Nope. You don't? No, nope. I didn't know that.
It's for testimony.
Not even for testimony. I think it's for experience because in Bergen, they don't get sprayed. They don't spray them in Bergen. Well, at least they didn't in 01 when I went.
I'd never got sprayed in the academy either.
Now, I got sprayed
when I became an OC instructor.
I got sprayed every year. Yeah. And with somebody with a skin tone like me, what that stuff did to me, it used to burn the hell out of me. And I would try to tell these guys, we don't need to do this every year. Why are we doing this?
But see, well,
we
gotta
because go. I'm a moron.
No, see, I was an OC instructor. The reason they spray you every year is because shits and giggles.
Oh, yeah, that's it, dude.
It's pretty funny.
It's like, you know, you're in the academy, you're learning about the hydraulic needle effect.
Oh, yeah.
Guess what? Nobody on earth has or is going to testify on the hydraulic needling effect.
Hydraulic needle effect is when you get sprayed right
too close,
directly
into your cornea and it damages your cornea. Like, who the fuck? Who is going to testify on the ulnar bone and where the handcuff goes? I've never heard of such a thing.
Support for the Suffering Podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, who's the best in men's below-the-waist grooming.
Their products are precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Manscaped Performance Package is the ultimate men's hygiene bundle.
Inside the package, you'll find the Lawnmower 4.0, Weed Whacker Ear Nose Hair Trimmer, and the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant.
And we also got the Crop Reviver Ball Toner. This thing is a life changer. Along with that,
boxer briefs.
I'm going to tell you what, these are like high quality boxer briefs, and this is no joke. I'm not saying this just because their Manscaped sent it to us. These are nice. My boys are going to be quite happy in there.
And you can't tell Kevin's wearing them under the table right now. And we also have a nice travel package.
Join over 8 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with this exclusive offer just for you. 20% off and free worldwide shipping with the code TSP at manscaped.com.
Jesus Christ, that's a lot of balls.
But that shit hurts, man.
Oh, yeah,
like that's terrible. So that's an argument that I use when people want to get the regular civilian wants to get their carry permit. I said, get yourself a can of OC spray. It'll do. You can use it a lot more freely, and it'll do a lot more damage than you think it will do. It won't do more damage than a gun, but this shit hurts.
Yeah, I don't know if civilians need to be getting pumped up to start deploying OC spray when they feel like danger is near.
Oh, no. Whenever I explain that to people, I said, just take a little bit on your thumb and put it right above your eyelid. That'll give you an appreciation for when you need to deploy it and when you don't need to deploy it.
Yeah, and then you go home and take a shower.
Ooh.
And it comes back again. And terrible. Man.
This I sprayed at two of my three academies, and we were gassed at the last two. Yeah. We call it gas bad in the third one. And I got to tell you, I'll take the spray all day over the gas.
Really?
All day.
See, I thought I was Mr. Big Balls in the academy, and we didn't have to do the gas at the time. They were phasing gas out, so they put it in the middle of the basketball court, and I go over there, and I was smoking at the time, and I go over there and I take a big, man, that was the worst thing I ever
did. It's bad.
That was, it freezes your lungs up.
Oh, it's awful.
Dude, it's bad.
But, you know, when you're a young cop.
At the last academy, this is in 05, they actually took vice grips, popped the ones they do for crowd dispersing. And held it. They made us line up, and this thing covers like, I don't know, thousands of square feet of space, and they ran it into your face, just a billowing smoke into your. It was nuts. That's why they use vice grips. The thing was piping red hot, and they just come along like they were like just smoking your face out. And dude, everybody lost their minds. The instructors were like, calm down. They're screaming. We were fucking hitting fences, running into fucking telephone poles.
The instructors have gas masks on.
Yeah, they have gas masks on. Yeah, they're tough guys.
You know, it's funny when people say, well, you know, why do I have to get sprayed with OC in order to carry it? And he said, well, you know, you got to know the effects. Well, I carry a gun and you're not going to shoot me. Yeah.
Well, I got to be honest with you. I think it's important to get sprayed.
I think so too.
So
you don't freak out.
Well, yeah. I've been sprayed, I don't know, about fucking 14 times because.
Easy.
Obviously, people are going to deploy spray in a fight. So the cool thing is for our agency, they actually spent the money on the antidote. So as long as I can't tell how many times I've parked my car.
The antidote.
Yeah, yeah. So you get right. So I got shot back to police headquarters multiple occasions. And then they have one wash goes in your face, and the next one is another pump. It's like a wash, and it's almost like a shampoo and conditioner, and it's done. It's over. Takes it out in like literally 20 seconds.
They generally tell you copious amounts of water.
No, they actually have an antidote for
the eye flush station.
It's expensive, so they left it in the armory so nobody can touch it. I think it's like $300 a gallon.
So the stuff that we use was just Johnson's baby soap.
Oh, they got the stuff that's I think Sabre makes it or somebody, yeah. And it's you can buy it, and it's literally. Pepper spray antidote.
I think we
and it's immediate.
I think we need to test that.
There's no oils, salves, you know, Latus.
I really think
like that
we need to test that.
It's fantastic. Well, when they got it.
Yeah, why don't we spray this room up one day and just do a show in here?
I'm sure Andrew will
love
that. You
guys can tell me all about it.
So when you got was being a street cop is what you wanted to do? Obviously, a lot of people will join corrections because they want to get on the road.
Well, dude, people don't realize that in the state of New Jersey at that time, getting a cop job is like impossible.
Yeah. It's the most competitive job market in New Jersey.
If you didn't get a 99 or 100 on the test, you weren't even
nuts.
On the list.
It was crazy. And you had to hit it at the right time.
You had to go to like Del Bagno. You had to go to, those different prep courses.
Yeah. I mean, it took me 3 times taking the civil service test to get to hit. You know, in the interim, I didn't want to be in corrections. I realized about the second day I was there that I better go back to college because this was not a place where I intended to be for very long. And I was pot committed. So I was taking literally every test that I get my hands on. And, you know, I took a job with the U.S. Park Police and I had no idea what they were. I didn't give a shit. All I knew was I'd have to go to a housing unit on a beautiful summer day and sit in with 48 inmates in a disgusting place for 8 to 16 mandatory hours of a shift.
And doesn't every jail smell the same?
Oh, it's awful.
It smells like you got that.
I'll be honest with you, dude.
I jail stink.
I don't know if there's anything I wouldn't do before I went back to being a corrections officer. And I not that I had a hard time. It's just the worst job I ever had. It taught me a lot. And the people who do it, I give a lot of credit to. I wasn't like losing my mind over it. It just, for a guy like me, it was brutal. It was torture because it was boring. And I, you know, I'm an outdoors guy being stuck inside. I'm not lazy. I'm a brain that needs to constantly be doing something. So it literally just almost was the opposite of what I ever needed to have. There was nothing. You learned good communication skills, but outside of that and recognizing some crime, people say, oh, you know, this is the correction officer to police statement that we all hear. I think the best cops were corrections officers first because you get the experience. And I'm like, yeah, I know a lot of good cops. They weren't corrections officers first.
Mike Arena actually opened my eyes to something. He said he wasn't allowed to bring food, his own food in there. There wasn't like a separate
cafeteria. You can't. Yeah.
That's insane to me. I'm gonna want these guys making my food.
It's wild, dude. Honestly, it is the worst job that you could possibly think of.
Well, Kevin, I mean, someone like you who's gluten free too.
What would you
be able to do?
I would fast. That's all I would do is fast. Because what am I? I'm not having these guys. I don't like anybody touching my food anyway. No less somebody who I'm in charge of guarding.
Yeah, dude, it is not a good place to be, and it's the only job that I have PTSD from. I have nightmares of being in jail.
Yeah, you're locked. You're a prisoner for 8 to 12 hours.
I always say corrections officers are more inmates than the inmates are, because the inmates could roam free. You got your post. You got to stay right there.
Well, it's a lot of dynamic to it, but it is a very difficult job, and you know, I admire and thank the men and women that do it because. I would never do it again.
It takes a special person to be a corrections officer. Well, it really does. I mean, like I said, I don't want people to think that we're putting down corrections officers or corrections itself.
No, it's a job I don't want to do.
Yeah, and they're doing it.
I don't want to be an Alaskan crab fisherman either.
Just like firemen. Like firemen. I don't want to be a fireman.
Nope. When you got into the park police, was it a little bit more freeing? You kind of breathed a little bit easier?
Oh, dude, I remember getting the call in the jail when I was getting hired. Dude, it's a crazy story. So I encouraged one of my coworkers to take the test with me. I'm like, dude, let's get the fuck out of here. Smart guy. You know, you're a good friend of mine. So he took the test and they were hiring 24. Brian was one of the first 24. I was number 25. So the ironic thing was that he was getting hired and I'm the one who told him to take it and I wasn't. So he had already gotten ready and prepared and did his 2 weeks notice. And I got a call and they were like, hey, what's your shoe size and your belt size? And I'm like, why? And they're like, am I going to the academy? And they're like, yeah, you're hired. And I'm like, oh, shit. And this is like, I remember it being maybe like 8. It was later. It was like 8 o'clock at night. My shift ended at 10, maybe. And or maybe 6 o'clock at night, something like that. Because I, my break, I walked down to the shift commander's office and I said, hey, Mike, how many vacation days do I have left to burn on sick days? He goes, you have 2 weeks. I go, I literally put my hand out. I said, it was a pleasure working with you. I think you're a great guy. Where do you want me to type my 2 weeks notice? He goes, there's a typewriter right there. So I typed it up, handed it to him and said, this will be my last shift. And it was nice working with you.
Wow.
And that was it, dude. And I can't express to you how thankful I was to be done with going to work there. It was literally one of the worst jobs of my life.
So do you understand, as we were walking in here, you're joking to me like, yeah, I, you know, I'm ready to suffer. I'm ready to suffer. You already went through it.
Oh.
You went through it.
My whole life's been suffering.
So you finally get that job and you move on to the police job. Now you got what you want.
Yeah, except I'm in D.C. And I didn't, and in 2004, well, police still had respect. And I still think they have respect, but they had a lot of respect in New Jersey. Being a cop in D.C. is like being a janitor. They fucking hate the cops there. They fucking hate the police. So, you know, I was like, this place is nuts. And I hated D.C. It had no culture. I still hate D.C. I think it's just a wild place that I have no interest in being in. It's, you know, I travel the country. It's not my favorite place to be. I don't like the attitude and the feeling of the separation of people there. It's a very, very segregated, no bullshit. Even though it's supposed to be like the epicenter of brotherhood,
no,
it is a very segregated place, and not one person is responsible for it. It's just, it's a weird thing, especially coming from a state where we're not segregated. You've got more friends, and I've got more friends that are Chinese, Black, Puerto Rican, Spanish. You know, like, we are friends with everybody.
See, right there, right behind the glass.
So to go somewhere where people weren't comfortable with each other or friendly towards each other was very weird for me. I could not handle that. Because, dude, you know how it is here, bro. Like, probably, you know, I mean, you could go to my backyard party on the 4th of July, and there's just a, looks like United Nations. Yeah.
But that's amazing. So most people's experience of D.C. is the mall, you know, and Congress building and the White House. And people don't realize that D.C. is really bad when you venture outside of those areas. And the dichotomy in there. So you could bring your family there and not know D.C. is one of the most dangerous cities in the world.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, growing up, too. I mean, Atlantic City.
Well, Atlantic
City. You go down into an obscene.
Two very different
things. So different.
Atlantic, D.C.'s have it. I mean, when I was there, they're doing a homicide a day.
Yeah, it's so different, like, with Atlantic City.
A homicide a day.
Guy went to the police academy. Bergen County Police Academy was a D.C. Metro cop. He had like four shootings under his belt.
Jesus.
Oh, I'm sure.
And he came back to Bergen County, and like you said, they made him do the whole academy again.
Ooh. So what drove you to leave that? Just because you hated D.C.?
Well, dude, first of all, the pay, the pension, the opportunity. I mean, they were paying into benefits in 2004. The pension system was like 30% after 25 years. It took 28 years in 2004 when everybody was 3 to 5 year top pays. It took 28 years to go to top pay. If you got promoted to sergeant, you didn't go to sergeant's pay. You went to a guy who has 6 years on the job as a sergeant. It's like an $800 pay increase. Like
prorated.
Wow. Oh, it's ridiculous. So I was like, I remember sitting there going through the process, and I'm like, they're like, pick a health plan. And I'm like, why? And they're like, because you got to figure out which one you want. I'm like, what difference does it make? Well, they're like, well, they have different prices on them. And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, yeah, you got to pay into your benefits here. So it said, the ad said starting at 46,000, tops at 98,000. I'm like, oh, it's top pay in 5 years, 98,000. This could be a good gig right at that time. And they're like, no, it's 28 years to top pay.
Wow. That's a lot of steps.
Years.
That's a lot of steps.
DC's
right there.
It's an expensive place to be. It's
expensive here.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, it's not cheaper. It's not like you're going down to the deep south.
So I just knew that for me, I am never satisfied, and I'm always looking for what the next best move is. And that's advice I give to people is, people say, what should I do next? Well, you know, as long as you're doing something better than the last step, it doesn't have to be your final step. Just figure out where you're going next.
Small advancement?
I think that's life. How could you look for a large advancement? You'll be looking forever. So it's one foot in front of the other, you know, one hand over the as you climb, one hand over the other. And, you know, I was willing to go back to the academy, and I never forget before I left Park Police, I sat with a major dude, an exit interview. And boy, we could have gave him what I really felt about the place. And he said, I'm going to tell you this right now. Be careful what you say in this exit interview, because we can take you back for a year. And if things don't work out where you go or you get hurt, we'll put you back in patrol immediately. Come back down here. We'll get you back in patrol. You go right back to work. You don't even got to qualify because you're still qualified for 6 months. So whatever you write on that, if you write something bad, they're not going to take you back, just so you know. He goes, that's between you and I. So I was like, all right, let me just play it smart and just write like, yeah, things are fantastic. But I remember him saying, like, if you don't want to be in the academy, you decide to quit, we'll have you back on the road. Literally just called me up and we'll have you right back on work. They were low on manpower too. So, and I remember being out in Somerset, January 12th at 6 a.m. with now a 100-pound rucksack, holding it, my hands turning literally purple because it's so cold and I'm holding this bag for so long. And it's funny is a couple of my friends were the drill instructors. They didn't know I was in the academy. So they came running around. You know, I'm 4.5 years on the job now at this point, right? 4.5. Yes, about 4.5 years I have on. And so they're running back up and they're screaming. They're like, oh my God, what are you doing here? I'm like, just yell at me. Just yell at me. Don't. And the first bathroom break I got, that's when they were talking to me. Like, you know, they're like, dude, I didn't know you're going to be here. And I'm like, yeah, just don't fucking play it off. Like, yell. I don't like whatever you got to do, dude. Like, you don't get to treat me any differently. And it was fun to have them in the academy as instructors because I used to work with them.
But, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, I personally think I had one of the best drill instructors.
Where'd you go, Bergen?
I went to Essex.
Okay.
I had a guy named Jimmy Marinara. He was a Force Recon Marine, very serious, and he would make us do things, which I used to think were very torturous. You know, I thought I was in good shape, but hold your arms up to the sides for a very long time, and you just watch your arms shake, and you're like, it's painful. But what he was doing was, if you're in a critical situation and you got to hold your gun up, you know, he used to make us hold our gun up like this. You got to hold your gun up forever. Well, you know, that can be a benefit to you down the road, or make you swim across the gym floor in your uniform. Well, that's what's going to happen during a critical incident. And it wasn't until I got out of the academy that I saw a lot of the benefit and value. But here's the main thing with him. And it goes back to the social media question. He never asked us to do anything he was unwilling to do himself. There was a guy at the range that would yell and scream at us, and he was this big fat guy. He didn't look the part of a cop. He loved to torture us just for the sake of torturing us. This guy, whatever we did, he did. Whatever the punishment was, he did it to show that it was possible. He led by example, and he was somebody that really, really impressed me.
But that fat guy, isn't that a form of bullying?
100%. 100%.
Because they're insecure about themselves, so they want to make you do something that they can't do.
You know,
I always said that I was a PT instructor, I was a football coach, and I ran the off season conditioning. I did every drill with those kids,
of course,
just to show them I could still do it. Mm-hmm. I was still running at the police academy at 55 years old, just to show these 22 and 23 year old Bergen County.
Okay,
I used just to show them.
Where'd you work?
Lyndhurst.
Okay,
just to show them if I could do it at 55, you should be able to do it at 22, 23 years old.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, and you dumb it down. And I take it to in every aspect of my life. I rarely will ever ask anybody something I'm unwilling to do myself. I will outwork most people in the world to my abilities. Mm-hmm. Just to show you that it's possible. Mm-hmm. It is possible.
And you see that a lot with supervision in law enforcement. They'll tell you, go do this, go do that, go do this. Because they don't want to do it themselves. When I was I retired as a lieutenant, I used to tell the guys, come on, let's go do this.
That's right.
You know, we got a call. Let's go do it.
That's right.
Not, so, you go do this, you go do that.
I was just watching Jocko Willink on a podcast. And if you ever do get him for street cop training, I need to be your guest. Because he's a genuinely good leader. He was just on a show and he says, you know how many times I told somebody, do this and do that? He goes, zero. I did that zero. Here's what I would do. I would go, okay, we got a problem. Let's make a plan up. Talk to me. Let's go back and forth. And that's how a leader leads from the front. But then you get into Somerset. Was it what you thought it was? Was the job what you thought it was?
Oh, well, I talk about the academy because best part about being a recruit three times was realizing how awful the training was on every fucking front. It's such an opportunity for 4 to 6 months, wherever state you're going to be in, to really train. And we completely drop the fucking ball and nothing gets done. You get literally dick. So everybody's told the same thing. Hey, you're going to go to the academy. You're not going to learn a thing. And guess what? They deliver on that promise. You don't learn a fucking thing in the academy. You know, I learned how to clean a handgun. That was cool. Right. I still use the same technique that the guy in Bergen County did. The guy who worked the range out there. I like that guy. Scott something or some shit.
Scott Williams.
Yeah. Yeah. So I like that guy. He was cool. It's fun. It was enjoyable. I learned how to clean a gun. He had his way. I still use it the same way. But outside of that, how did we spend 6 months in academy and learn literally nothing that's useful? Nothing. Zero. You had people training that had no idea what they were talking about. Most of them.
Because it's more about liability than
it has nothing to do with liability. It has to do with saying they did something. And so that's what I imagine when you made an academy curriculum, whatever part of this country, and I'm guessing in the late 60s, early 70s, when academies started becoming mandatory, when somebody wrote this program, I could only imagine what that conversation was like. Hey, Kev, I don't know, Mike, what do you think? We got to do this fucking academy. The fucking politicians want it. What are we going to do? I don't know. What's on your belt? You got a pair of handcuffs? Hey, do a 4-hour block on handcuffs. Well, what are you going to talk about? I don't know. Talk about the fucking ratchet, where the key goes, the chain. Do a little 5-person quick question on that. What else you got? You got that pistol, right? Yeah. I don't know. What do you make him shoot or something? Yeah, make him shoot. I don't know. Let's come up with some bullshit. How about that stick on your belt? Yeah, we'll talk about the stick. We'll make him swing a stick in a bag for 15, 20 hours. Guys, we've got another 100 hours left to fill in. What else you want to do? Ah, with the stick. Make a slide about the stick and a 5-question quiz about what the parts of the stick are. Well, is this going to help anybody in the street? No.
Georgia State takedown. You remember that one with the PR-24?
Yeah, PR-24.
Oh, like you slide your thing up and...
It's like a 6-point movement that you will never do. Never. I don't know anybody who's done a Georgia State takedown with a PR-24.
I remember being a new recruit at Bergen County, and I said to I don't want to say his name because I do like the guy. They were teaching pressure points, and I said to him, I go, would this stuff ever actually work in real life? And he literally said, probably not.
Was it a doctor?
No.
Oh.
Yeah. So, you know, it was very... So at the end, I'm like, why did we spend all this? How did I go through 77 weeks of academies? And I will give credit where credit's due. The Federal Law Enforcement Training Center was the better of the three. They had some real thoughtful programs, which I appreciated. That's the only academy where I actually got some real skills, like high-intensity training. So like we were doing, you know, use of force with high-intensity physical training. Then we were doing move and shoot. That was really important. We were doing officer down shooting, low light shooting. The driving training there was fantastic. They have unlimited resources. I mean, you want to talk about learning how to drive? Those motherfuckers will teach you how to drive at that academy because I can drive. And then I come here, I'm at the third academy, and like they're setting up cones at the fucking Rutgers parking lot. And they're like, all right, you could only go up to about 32 miles an hour. You're going to have to slam the brakes. That's as fast as we can go on this track. This is real life pursuit training, right? This is real life. You set up cones in a parking lot? Like, what are we talking about here?
So it's funny you say that because my drill was very, very tactically oriented.
Was it called the Iron Cross? Remember that? Some shit like that.
He was very tactically oriented. And I remember he got a lot of pushback from the administration on the academy of some of the things that he was doing. He taught high-risk motor vehicle stops. He taught, you know, he was very focused on PT. He was very focused on discipline because these are all the things that are going to teach you how to survive out on the street. And I remember you could see it. You could see there was discussions going on and, you know, his hands are going up, going pretty much saying, well, why can't I do this? This is the stuff that they're going to need and they're going to learn. Everything he did had a purpose. And, you know, it's funny, you said, looking back in retrospect, you're right.
You know, I think the problem with the academies is the PTC guidelines.
Well,
the PTC tells you what you have to teach and you have to get out point A, point B, point C.
Right, because...
And it's very, very, it's listen, very static.
You can't take status quo or the bare minimum when you're teaching people how to protect life.
Yeah.
And there has to be more thought. The problem is it's so political. Everybody's got their sandbox and nobody's willing to relinquish some of what they've got to say to somebody, hey, we know it's bad. Do you have any thoughts and ideas on how to fix this? Nobody's willing to listen. So that's where the company came from is we're not waiting for your politicians to fix things. We're not waiting for somebody who doesn't know how to fix it to show up and try to fix it.
Of course,
we're fixing it.
We're talking about street cop training.
Well, that's the whole thing, man. So how do we expect a professional law enforcement officer to appear magically when we give him nothing to work with?
Especially in this day and age, sure. Where the heavily scrutinized.
How much case law did you learn in the academy?
Not a lot.
None.
No.
How about none?
No, a guy named Donnie Allen, who was a cop next town over, who was really into case law. It was like his hobby. He got me into case law.
Okay.
Yeah, that's. But that wasn't none, right? That wasn't in the academy. That was after the academy.
I think you learned the only time you really learned case law is when they were talking about like breathalyzer before the ALCO test.
Yeah, but we didn't get that in the academy though. I didn't anymore.
No, we didn't get in the academy either. But,
oh yeah, you're right. It's that was a in service training.
Mm-hmm. I went to three academies. Case law wasn't talked about once.
Yeah.
How was that possible?
I don't think it was. Maybe a little bit. A guy named Dennis Alamo, who was a great instructor, he talked about it a little bit. I think a little bit, but that was a 6 hour block, but 4 hour.
In
block.
Order to, have,
I was going to say that's an instructor at a CARESnet,
right? But you know, in order to have one of the four significant pillars of law enforcement, to be able to go out and act professionally and within the confines of the Constitution of the United States of America, or you know, just following what the rules are, you've gotten no playbook on what the rules are, so you just go out and make them up as you go because you watch other guys do it, or you watch cops or live PD or whatever it's called, on patrol live now, and you think because they did it, it must be constitutionally justifiable. And the reality is when I watch those shows, it motivates me and I realize how much of a fucking disaster this entire profession is, but made up of great people, but we're a fucking wreck.
Before we get there, did you develop this concept of street cop training while you were on the job?
Yeah, so I was taking notes. So people would ask me, like, yo, how do you get the things that you get? How do you know the things that you know? And I was having profound success with the people I was field training. They were coming out and really just – if they had a half a brain, which some of them didn't, but I still liked them as human beings. If they had a half a brain, I mean, I'd be getting accolades from the administration. Like, you know, I'd tell them, you got guys going to the academy. We were a big agency, so we always had like 7 to 15 guys in the academy every 6 months. Tell me who you have that has potential and send them to me. Don't give me the guy that nobody can save, even Jesus. Jesus made him this way. We can't make him any better, right? I'm not Jesus. But I am able to take somebody with potential who is motivated and is sharp, and I will make them a fantastic police officer. And that was the result. So people would ask me, like, hey, can I do ride-alongs? How do you find this stuff? So I was like, let me just start taking notes of the things that I see, the things that I'm looking for. So it really was, you know, when I knew people were lying to me, what cars I was selecting to stop and how I would get results. And, dude, I literally wrote on a legal notepad for 6 to 8 months. And then I broke my hand and got it into a PowerPoint.
You knew what you needed and what you wanted before you knew what you needed and what you wanted. You were just...
I mean, I'm watching a profession of people who have no idea what they're doing. I'm working with agencies. And fortunately enough for us, we were civil service. So the good thing about that in the state of New Jersey is if you're a civil service agency to get promoted, you must read case law. It's the rules. So we were lucky enough to have supervisors who were versed, and some of them very well versed in case law. So what we were doing may have looked like a bit of a pain in the ass to the outside agencies, but we were actually compliant with the Attorney General guidelines and Article 1, Paragraph 7 under the U.S. New Jersey Constitution. So we were good at that. But then we go to other agencies, and they're not civil service. Not a soul in the building has ever read a piece of case law. So we're telling them, like, you guys can't do that. You guys must do this. You can't do that. You guys... Did you guys know you can do that? No, we can't. No, yeah, you can. There's a case law.
I ran into that in my department. Okay, I pulled a it was a disabled vehicle, and I noticed that the people were it was an officer who wasn't very street smart. I noticed they're trying to get him away from the car. Mm-hmm. All right, so what do I do as a backup officer? I go over and take a look in the car, plain view seizure.
Right.
So one of the administration shows up and says, you can't illegally search a car. And I said, I didn't. Now, mind you, I've got like 3 years on. I didn't illegally search a car. It was some dime bags. It was nothing but some seeds or whatever. I said, I'm checking for safety. I'm acting in behalf of a secondary officer. I was pulled in, and I had to write a memo because they said it wasn't the philosophy of the police department. So now I'm starting to get pissed. Now, because first you start thinking, well, they're the bosses. Okay, they'll probably know a little bit better. But then you start doubting them, and I start to get pissed. And I start reading the law enforcement handbook page to page. I start getting case law and stuff like this. And I'm highlighting stuff. I'm underlining stuff. And this is probably the downfall of my career. When they asked me to go in there and do this, they were like, well, it isn't the police department's philosophy. And I said, well, where's that written? And they said, well, it's not written. It's just something we teach you. And I said, what I did is right here, underlined, highlighted. This is what's going to save me in a court of law if something goes sideways. So tell me where I have that back on that. And they couldn't answer me. I took a lot of shit for that because I questioned. But I wasn't wrong, and I knew I wasn't wrong. That's where. And then when that happens, especially with your administration, when you figure out the holes in the system, now everything they say is going to be questioned.
They want blind followers.
Well, you know, it's funny because I always hated when they say, well, we've never done it that way.
Oof.
Yeah.
Well, why not? Well, it's an evolving career. It's an evolving position that you're in. You know, we've always done it this way. Well, maybe your fucking way is wrong.
Probably is wrong.
But they're so set in their ways. Like we always talk about the dinosaurs. They're set in their fucking ways, and they don't want change.
Guys, it's a fake world in law enforcement. how do you get promoted the way you get promoted? It's not based on anything other than either a test or politics.
Yeah.
So how the fuck could you, none of it's real. So you'll see these guys leave law enforcement and come into private business, and they can't figure out why they were a captain at 33, but can't make a dollar at fucking at their retirement because they're so fucking bad and so stupid. Is because you can't take a test in the real world and get paid. You don't get to go, give me money. I scored a 99.3 on my next promotional exam. I'm the best test taker there is. Welcome to the real world. And I'll be honest with you, later on in life, I realized I'm probably one of those guys who should have never worked for anybody.
So how many people have you met who should have been police chiefs, but for that same reason, they will never be a police chief?
I always tell people, you know, there's a lot of great chiefs. I'm friends with a lot of guys who I think are fantastic. There's a lot of great lieutenants and captains and sergeants. You know, but there's also a lot of bad ones. And, you know, I say sometimes you go into the building and you knock on the door and they go, who are you looking for? The dumbest fucking person here. The third floor chief's office, right? Well, where's the smartest guy here? Squad 2 patrol division. But he'll never see chief because his cousin isn't a council member. Maybe he's not a good test taker, but he's a fantastic leader and a street smart guy and a great human being. But he'll never get there. And when that chief at the top is an insecure piece of shit, and he's threatened by a guy like that, he'll never promote him.
Bury him.
That's right.
You ever see The Untouchables? Sean Connery says that in The Untouchables. When they go to the range to pick out, you know, they don't want a bad apple, you go to the tree and not pick one up off the ground. And they get the one guy and they say, well, why do you want to become a police officer? Because I want to do some good and protect and serve and stuff like that. And he walks away and Sean Connery looks at Kevin Costner and goes, there's your next chief of police.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's wild, dude. Yeah. And that's the one thing that I'm not thrilled with the profession, and I really don't like government work in general, but the people doing this job are the best human beings I've ever met. So I'll never turn to people who say, well, will you go to Oregon and teach? Will you go to Spokane or wherever these fucking liberal places are? I go, if there are police officers showing up to do the job, how dare I not show up to help them do it better and stay safe?
Because then you're just as guilty as the people you're criticizing. Exactly.
You're part of the system.
Right. So I have – you know, they've got to meet the criteria for us to go out and expend our energy out there. But man, I mean, even though I may not like the system and how it's designed, and dude, they use it against me. I'm even out of the game and I'm a political pawn now in this state. And we don't have to go into that, but I'm subjected to it still. And I'm like, dude, I have friends that are fucking billionaires. I'm talking about, I got a friend who's shopping NFL teams. No bullshit. He's shopping NFL teams. I'm not making that up. And I'm like, you know, sometimes I'm like, I could just go do that. I could just go work with these guys, make 10 million bucks a year. And but I won't do it because it's not fair to the kids who are expecting their dad to be at Christmas this year. Yeah, so I just won't do that.
Now you have something tangible. Like you have a legacy that you're creating. You're creating better cops through training, through education. And that's your legacy. If you were to go out and have all that money, right, that'd be great. That'd be wonderful. And I'm sure you'd have a great time doing it. But I don't know whether you'd get the same amount of satisfaction.
Well, I have to be honest with you. None of this is about me. And if it was, I would have been gone a long time ago. Because what I go through emotionally is fucking horrible. It's worse than being a cop. No bullshit. There are great highs and then great lows.
You said it to me perfectly. Say it about having your head underwater. What's it like running a company?
It's like literally getting your face smashed into water and you're gasping and you're choking and your hands are flailing and you're praying that for a second you're going to get a breath of air, and they pull your head up and you get to look around and go, wow, the world's a beautiful place. This is great. I can't believe that I've made it here. And you get shoved back down to that fucking thing of water and you're drowning again. And dude, right now, mid-June to mid-August is our slow season. There's an opportunity to innovate, but at the same time, this is the worst financially part of the year for us. So I am reminded every time about this time every year of like, oh, this is scary, right? Like, fuck, dude, like we are like it's, and people are like, hey, the bank's not like our numbers aren't looking great. And I'm like, I know, but we go through this for the past like 10 years. This has been the same thing over and over again. Just hold your breath till about August 15th, maybe August 21st, when all the secretaries come back around and start re-registering people for classes. But we're facing a new dynamic as a company. It's why we're shifting to other new products, is that we have people making phone calls to put asses in seats at classes. And this is what we hear 97% of the time. Hey, we got the money. We like your training. We can't send anybody. We got nobody to work the road. So this is a new problem we're facing. We're down to, statistically, I read something the other day, and I don't know how factual it is. We're at 660,000 cops. We're down about 90,000 cops in the country. So if you do the math on that, that's a lot when you talk about manpower issues, especially start heading states like, dude, the state of South Dakota has 1,200 cops total, right? Yeah. If you try to unpack that a little bit, they're 10 times the size of New Jersey, and they have 1,200 cops. Damn. You got 1,300 in the city of Newark, 25 minutes down the road. So when you're talking, they're down 300-400 cops. The whole state is down 20-30% of cops.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So that's a problem for us because that's how our bread and butter is made. What I'm going to do now is cater to the problems that we're facing because we know the cops still need training. They just can't get to go to the training, so we must bring the training to them. One thing people will never be able to replace is our quality of training product. You can people say, oh, you give your stuff away all the time. I go, you're not me. You can have anything that I have. If it helps you, fantastic. You want to steal it and try to teach it, good luck. Because you can't explain the things that we can explain. You don't know what we know. You don't have case law experts like we do. Even the guys who proclaim to be case law experts, they're fucking idiots. We know that because we have one of the best, in the maybe the best in the country. Zach Miller works for us. And, you know, he'll look into something. He's like, hey, that guy's stuff is not that good. He is not doing a good job. He's not explaining. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And Zach's not a guy who's looking. We're not looking to lock horns with people. But we know that the work we do is important and it's reliable. And, you know, I have a responsibility now and I really take that seriously. But I also have a life. I'm still a father and I still want to have things and I still go through things.
You give off this appearance of this squared away, successful guy, runs an incredibly successful business. But it's also important to let people know that, yeah, you struggle with the same things that they're struggling with in their small businesses or their large businesses. That's an important thing because it's the vulnerabilities. Cops are so good at this. Cops are so good at letting everybody see a certain side that they're okay, they're perfectly okay, and inside they're a mess.
They're melting.
So I'm glad that you shared that, and I want you to keep sharing that.
The guy said to me, people come to me at the conference, and they're, yeah, listen, man, it's very, very honorable. It's very exciting, and I'm pleased to be able to give people the opportunity to. That salad place, I walk in, a guy's like, no shit, what are you doing here? I'm like, yeah, what's up, man? He's like, oh my God, dude, this is fucking great. Like, I thought I recognized your voice. I heard you on the phone. He's like, I can't believe you're here. And I'm like, yeah. I wasn't even thinking about getting a picture. I was working on other stuff. So, but at the conference, and people were like, man, I can't believe I'm meeting you. I'm like, listen, dude, like, it's Thursday. I promise you on Saturday morning, I'm cleaning up dog shit in the backyard fucking in New Jersey. Like, I'm going to be with a fucking little thing out there cleaning up dog shit. I'm going to be fucking, running the vacuum in my pool, taking care of dad shit, being at Little League, going to get pizza in the afternoon. I'm no different than you. This is just my job. This is what I do. And I'm glad that I do it because I think it's important. None of it's for me. And, you know, it's either feast or famine. So,
what gives you more satisfaction, street cop training or being a cop?
I guarantee being a dad gives them more.
Yeah, that's I don't even want to pose that question because
I thought that's where you were going.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know. I think in different parts of my life, different satisfaction was felt. I feel like in some weird way, the Lord gave me 14 years and said, it's enough. Well, now I need you to do other work. And, you know, I say this to people, like, I thought I was doing a lot of work as a cop.
We say the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, I did 14 years. Mike did 20 years. And we went to work one day. We could no longer return to work. And it's like, you're like, now what? But that's what I like doing this show is it's almost equally as satisfying.
Right.
Well, you know, I mean, we talked about it on Instagram Live today, paying it forward. Mm-hmm. Isn't this what we're doing? We're paying it forward.
That's what you're doing.
Yeah, that's what you're doing. You're paying it forward.
Well, you know, I think that I would tell people like, hey, I thought I was doing a lot of work as one cop. And then when I started teaching guys that I work with, I'm like, it's nice to watch 3 to 5 to 7 other guys go out and do the work. And then when I started teaching people, I'm like, that's cool. We're getting like hundreds of cops now. And now to watch thousands of cops go out and do the work, it's much more satisfying. And my role is different. Now I'm not even really instructing as much as I once was because that's not my role. So I was an instructor having impact on thousands. Now I'm many instructors. I'm just their leader and guide them and set them up for success. And we teach, you know, I don't know, maybe this year we'll probably teach 40 to 50,000 cops.
Wow, that's great.
You know, so, and that's important. And the threshold is set high for the brand of this company. You just don't get to become a street cop instructor. People who've made it to their final stages, and I'm like, yeah, you're not going to be one, and they're like, I don't understand. I'm like, no, it's not going to work. I can't put my name on this. It's for whatever reason it may be. And sometimes it's their behavior. Sometimes it's just their lack of knowledge that they had me duped on. I thought they really know what they were talking about. But at the beginning of it, it's we probably take 2 to 3% of people who apply to work with this company. 2 to 3%, we probably get 60, 70 applications a month. And we probably have 18, 19 men and women working on their programs, almost finished, coming out with new programs because we found experts. Like, who would you rather learn money from? My father, who's a fucking electrician at the Port Authority, or Donald Trump? So when we go to academies, you're learning money from my father, who had no money, where we should be learning money from Donald Trump or, you know, Warren Buffett or anybody who actually knows money, who's wealthy. But when you go to the academy, that the bar sets so low, you're learning from people who don't know what they're talking about. I can prove that. And I'm saying that, again, to my detriment. It's happening to me now because they get very frustrated that they're being exposed. What I'm saying is, how can you be upset when we're trying to fix something that inherently saves lives and creates less names on that wall in Washington, D.C.? How the fuck can you comfortably say you're doing a good job when you know you're not, and you won't relinquish it to those who can help to save the lives of your quote unquote brothers and sisters?
It's almost like complacency. You know, the old, if it's not broke, don't fix it theory.
It's wild.
So they've been sitting there teaching the same fucking thing year after year after year, just going through the motions to get people through the academy.
Because they have a certificate that says MOI on it.
Yeah.
And they
checking boxes, brother.
They have that certificate, that MOI certificate, and it's a political certificate. I don't care what anybody says, because if you were a guy your department didn't like, they're not sending you to MOI.
Here's a little early onset of I put myself through MOI because it's a long story, but I got became a firearms instructor like 6 months on the job at my last agency. It's because my field training officer was the range master, and he liked me. He trusted me. He knew I was a bro. I'm a hell of a shot. And I'm a nice guy. Not a dick. Everybody, you know, people, once they get to know me, like me at that time. Sometimes it's hard to, you know, to gain some friends. Well, because I'm very confident. I put myself through. I asked to go to MOI. They refused to send me. I paid my way through. It was $199 to go through MOI because I wanted to teach the academy. And if you let too much time pass as a firearms instructor, you'd have to go back through firearms instructor school if you didn't get MOI, because you couldn't teach the academy if you'd have them like within 3 years of each other. So MOI came up, and this is kind of a funny story. The program that I wrote my course on, they kind of let us for the third one, they let us do whatever we wanted. So I wrote a hysterical program on, at that time, like Jersey Shore was just popping off. So it was Guido identification. And they came to me and said, that was the best. We've been doing this 20 years. That was the best performance we ever. And this is the first time I'm teaching. I go, we're going to ask you this question. You could say no if you don't want to do this, but would you do that again for the other side of the class? That was so fucking funny. So just to go to show you, like, it really was the path that I was going down because I really wanted to teach and entertain. And I remember a guy coming to class, and he's like, he was teaching on, I think my second program was on like interdiction, how important criminal apprehension was. And this guy came in and he was teaching. You know, the thing that like they play a rubber tube across the road and it counts the cars. Mm-hmm. He's brought that in. He's like, I'm the traffic division. And I was like, teach about criminal interdiction, why it was so important. I'm like, you know, here's the reasons why. Da-da-da. We'll catch murderers. We'll catch these guys. We'll catch felons. We'll catch drugs. We'll catch guns. Inherently. And he's like, you know, that's a thing of the past. And I'm like, what do you mean? And this prosecutor I later had problems with would tell him, don't do work like that. That's how cops get in trouble. And I said to him, dude, you're a fucking clown. Like, you're literally sitting here hammering tickets down like a psychopath. And you're the guy that everybody really hates. For me, and dude, I wouldn't have had a fruitful career even after that class of well over 1,000 arrests with literally zero complaints. You know, like, so his theory based on what this person told him was completely false. But what he could do is find three other people that would subscribe to it with him so he could find his dumb fucking friends to make excuses why they weren't good cops. We'll go out, write tickets, we'll do the traffic division. Like, hey, bro, like, and people apologize when I talk, like, hey, I work traffic, not because I like writing tickets, but like, I need the schedule for my kids' baseball. And I'm like, no, dude, I get it. Right? I'm not, my point is don't believe somebody else's story. Find out for yourself.
Well, that's a big piece of advice right there. Believe, make your own mind up, because when you inevitably, for those people who want to become police officers, and you make your mind up, you get into that department, there's going to be people the administration like and they don't like, and people are going to say, don't trust this person, but trust this person. Make your own mind up. I learned that very
early. Oh, I got to go through that advice now.
Make your own mind up. See with your own eyes. Judge them on how they treat you and their intentions behind what they treat you.
I always say, be you.
Yeah.
Just be you.
You're the best guy in the building was.
Don't try to be anybody else.
The guy could talk to anybody, and I was him. Yeah. Outside of two or three people I like, hopefully got pushed off a cliff by this point in their life, I could go and talk to anybody. You know, I can go, and I could, I don't want to say that I was comfortable enough to get things done, but I think I earned the respect of a lot of people. And even people who didn't want to give me the respect gave it to me because they knew I deserved the respect. And I get calls from some of these guys sometimes, and I'm like, why is this fucker calling me? Right? Like, hey, we're doing a thing. You know, we're talking about it. If anybody knows anything about this stuff, it's got to be you. We're trying to put something together. What do you think? What's your thoughts? And I'm like, oh, the guy talks shit about me behind my back. Yeah. Needs me again.
Yeah, exactly. Gotcha. If you were an officer and they wanted to get involved in a street cop training class, where do they go?
Streetcop.com. Man, you can just put it into Google. We're on every social platform, TikTok, Instagram. Our Facebook group is a significant resource where you have all of our instructors. There's over 50 of us now. Engaging in the group, answering questions that you have. You have other resources there as well. You know, and we make it very interesting. We have 100,000 cops in that group, 100,000 vetted police officers. We have the podcast, the Street Cop podcast, that's people are enjoying.
We're going to put links to all of these on our show notes.
Just figure out, talk about it. We even, you know, so it's, you can follow us on Instagram. There's a lot of good stuff out there. And our content's free, man. We're not even asking for anything for it. Yeah, do we have to make money? We're a business. Of course we do. But what you get in return for your investment is tenfold and life-changing.
Officer safety.
You know, if you're not
really what
advanced,
it's all about.
Like you said, you got to always advance. If you're not advancing your career every single day, whether you're an accountant, whether you're a cop, whether you're a fireman, if you're not reading or advancing your career every single day, then you're not a professional. Someone told that to me a long time ago. I certainly believe that.
There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Dennis, thank you so much for coming in. We are coming to the end of this thing here, and I always end it with this same question. You went through a lot of different sufferings in order to get this great company of your street cop training on the map. What do you think it's taught you?
If you let anxiety dictate your decisions because you're scared of what people will think, or you're scared of how you're going to make ends meet and you don't trust yourself, you're going to be an old person, 85, 90 on your deathbed, having a lot of fucking regrets.
Still reaching.
Yeah, I'm telling you, you're going to have a lot of regrets. And I brought this up recently. I know a girl who is a beautiful girl, beautiful soul, and a wonderful person. And she's in this crappy situation and refuses to leave. And I told her, one of the last times I talked to her was, you're going to have some real regret. Because you are wasting your life. You are missing out on some of those beautiful things. And I think people should really understand what anxiety is and how to ensure that that does not dictate your decisions, and use fear as a North Star. If it feels like it's scary, it's probably where you should go.
Use fear as a North Star.
Yeah. I like that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Dennis, I can't thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Listen, guys, I'm honored to be here, man. It was a blast.
It was great meeting you, man. You're doing great stuff.
It was worth $94 in gas to come here.
Well, that's because you drive one of the gas cars.
No, it's a hybrid. It's a hybrid.
Oh, it's a hybrid. It's a truck?
Bro, it's a Platinum, brother.
Ah, you know. I got you.
Man, being a street cop and the owner is not that bad. You know? I didn't bring the Benzo up. I'm just saying.
It's good to be the king.
Yeah.
That's going to do it for this episode of the Suffering Podcast, The Suffering of Street Cop. And let's think about all the stuff that we learned. We all want to go home to our families. You sacrifice for this job. Always make an advancement, but most importantly, be able to put your name on it. That's going to do it for this episode. Don't forget to go to popple.com for a digital business card. Put in the code TSP20 for a 20% discount. Follow us on all social media, LinkedIn, Instagram, TikTok, Clapper, Facebook, Twitter. Follow Mike at Mike_Fillets. Follow me at Real Kevin Donaldson. And of course,
tell them to comment.
Yeah, comment. Please comment. I get back to everybody. And of course, don't forget to follow the Suffering Podcast. And we will see you on the next episode.